made what amends he could with the roommate I had left in the lurch so irresponsibly. Once we reconnected, my dad shipped me some of my stuff. He paid my outstanding bills. He fathered me, despite everything I was doing, to be unparented. And then it all ended. I came home to an eviction notice on my apartment door. The couple I was living with was frantically packing all their belongings as if everything were just fine. I panicked because I had, in my still relatively sheltered and privileged life, never known such a thing. As I cried and freaked out, I packed my stuff into a trunk and left it with a friend. I considered my options, but didn't want to go home. I wasn't ready. With what money I had, I bought a plane ticket to Minneapolis. I went to Minnesota in the dead of winter to stay with a girl I met on the internet. This would become a pattern, meeting lovers online. At first, I did it because it felt safer and I could be sexual without having to actually be sexual. Then, as I got fatter, it was a way to meet people and hopefully charm them with personality before having to show them the truth of my big body. I thought the girl in Minnesota was the love of my life. This would also become a pattern. 2 weeks later, I realized she wasn't the love of my life. She was a stranger, and I had nothing. No money, nowhere to live, no job. I broke down and called my parents. My father told me to go to the Minneapolis airport, and I did, and there was a plane ticket waiting for me. Again, he fathered me. Though they did not have to, though they were frantic with worry, my parents welcomed me home. They had questions and anger and hurt, and I couldn't do much about any of that. I could not tell them the truth. I could not explain why I continued to gain so much weight. I could not figure out how to be less of a disappointment. And still, I knew I had a home to return to, a home where I would be welcomed and loved. I was still a mess. I spent a lot of time in my room, on my computer, tying up the phone line with my modem, which did not go over well with the rest of my family. It was easier to lose myself in the virtual world than to try and put my life back together or face these people who thought they knew me. I was still broken, and I liked how it felt to simply accept that everything was wrong and couldn't be set right. It felt good to not try and pretend. 27. After several tense months of living at home in Omaha, I moved to Lincoln, about 50 miles away. I wanted my independence and my space and to feel like an adult even though I was so far from being an adult. I was 20 years old, and I felt like I was 12 years old, and I felt like I was 20 years old, and I felt like I was 100 years old. I knew nothing, but I thought I knew everything. The apartment, subsidized by my parents, of course, was a one-bedroom with a tiny kitchen and a balcony where I smoked with continued enthusiasm. I went to my parents' house often, and I would stock up on toilet paper and groceries from my mother's pantry. Things were still fractured between us, but I knew, as always, that I had a home. I had a very well-financed crack-up. I did not go hungry, even as I hungered for so much. To at least try to support myself, I held a series of odd jobs. Adult video store clerk, telemarketer, Gallup poll taker, loan consolidator at a student loan company, and quickly realized that without a college degree, I was only ever going to work odd jobs for minimum wage. I was readmitted to Yale, but the thought of returning to New Haven was unbearable. I turned 21 and celebrated by buying a six-pack of Corona, even though I hate the taste and stink of beer. Later that night, a woman I was casually dating called, and when I mentioned it was my birthday and I was sitting alone in my apartment with a sweaty six-pack of cheap beer, she offered to show me a good time. I don't even remember what we did. I had no friends. I ended up finishing my degree through a brief residency program at Vermont College, which was, at the time, part of Norwich University, a military college in Vermont. I wrote and wrote and wrote. I very much wanted to be a writer, so I enrolled in the MA program in creative writing at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. I worked at night and went to school during the day. I was broke all the time, which is not to be confused with being poor. I had a safety net, and I knew I had a safety net. And though there were many days I was fueled by ramen, still I did not go hungry while I hungered. I rarely slept, because it was in sleep that I was forced to confront myself, my past. I was tormented by terrible dreams, memories really, of those boys, the woods, my body at their lack of mercy. At the university, I went to classes and learned about Victorian literature and cultural theory and postcolonialism, and I sat in workshops with students who were surprisingly generous in their feedback about my writing, given common wisdom about writing workshops. I served as an editorial assistant for Prairie Schooner, the program's literary magazine, and was mostly relegated to opening all the incoming mail, hundreds of submissions a week from writers like me who just wanted to be discovered. It was there that I learned that one of the best ways to measure where you stand as a writer is to work at a literary magazine. We received all manner of submissions. People sent in diaries, odes to their cats, entire novels or books of poetry, all carefully printed out and stuffed into manila envelopes. There were many submissions from prisoners who were just as lonely as I was, who had found their voices in their prison cells and wanted their voices to be heard. I pored over the cover letters from all these writers who would share seemingly anything about their lives. When I got home at night, I generally went straight to my computer, where I wrote story after story, mostly about women and their hurt, because it was the only way I could think of to bleed out all the hurt I was feeling. I frequented news groups and chat rooms for survivors of sexual assault. Though I couldn't tell anyone in my real life what had happened, I unburdened myself to strangers on the internet. I blogged, mostly about the minutiae of my life, hoping, I think, to be seen and heard. I loved and craved the freedom of being online and being free from my life and my body. I ate and ate and ate, but rarely was any of the food I ate memorable for any reason but the quantity. I ate mindlessly just to fill the gaping wound of me, or to try to fill the gaping wound of me. No matter how much I ate, I still hurt, and I was still terrified of other people and the memories I couldn't escape. I managed to put together a collection of short stories for my thesis entitled How Small the World, and successfully defended my thesis, and then I was done with school and I had no idea what to do, so I got a job working at the university as a writer for the College of Engineering. I tried to do what was expected of me. Some days I tried really hard. 28. As I spent more time working at the College of Engineering, I realized that when I had dreamed of making a living as a writer, I probably should have been more specific about what exactly I meant by that. And still, every day I got to write. I had my own office and a computer on which I could play solitaire and work on my own writing. I mostly wrote articles about faculty research, things that I knew nothing about and that the faculty were more than eager to explain to me, on robotic construction equipment, aerogels that could be used in space, defenses against bioterrorism, innovative uses for RFID chips. The job was fine, by far the best job I had ever had, making the most money I had ever made, even though I was not making much money at all. I had a great, encouraging supervisor named Constance, who made me a much better writer. I learned how to use the Adobe Creative Suite. I worked with the undergraduate engineering students as the advisor of their magazine. And still, I would sit in professors' offices listening to them talk about their research and think, I could totally do what they do. Certainly, that was a bit grandiose, but I was working 10-hour days, always at someone else's whim. I envied the freedom faculty seemed to have, teaching 2 or 3 times a week, setting their own schedules, and being handsomely compensated. I wanted to live that life. Throughout my MA program, I had always intended to get my PhD, but I was going to get my PhD in creative writing and write my great Haitian American novel and get a teaching job and be set for life. And then, as one of my work duties, I went to the annual conference for the National Society of Black Engineers to man a recruitment table for the College of Engineering. The woman whose table was across the aisle from mine throughout the conference, Betty, began talking to me about the school she worked for, Michigan Technological University, and how they had a great technical communication program. I had never heard of Michigan Tech, and was certain that I'd be staying at UNL. After the conference, though, she stayed in touch, and she was persistent. Then the woman I thought I was in a relationship with broke up with me on Valentine's Day via email, and suddenly I wanted to be as far away from Lincoln as possible. I applied to Michigan Tech, was accepted, and they made me an offer I could not refuse. Enough money to nearly match my salary, teaching opportunities, tuition remission, and terrible health insurance. That summer, I moved to Hancock, Michigan, sight unseen, to attend a doctoral program at a school I had never heard of, in a field I knew nothing about. My brother Michael Jr. transferred to Michigan Tech and joined me. As we drove into town, we both realized that we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. The Upper Peninsula was so very remote. The two-lane country highways we took for hours were dwarfed by trees thick with leaves. There were deer everywhere as the sun set, so we slowed to a crawl. When I met my landlord, who lived in the upstairs unit of an old building where she and her deceased husband had run a dry cleaner, she stood behind her latch screen door as my brother and I stood on her porch. She peered out at me and said, "You didn't sound like a colored girl on the phone." I was 30 years old. 29. There was something comforting about graduate school and living a life of the mind. My body didn't matter because I was in school, taking classes and learning things. I was learning how to teach on the job. I had very specific responsibilities that demanded nearly all of my focus, my time, and energy. But I couldn't forget my body. I could not escape it. I didn't know how, and the world was always there to remind me. On my first day of teaching, a Monday, I threw up before a class because I was terrified, though not of the teaching itself. I would be teaching freshman composition, and while managing a classroom is always a challenge, I felt comfortable imparting onto my students the basics of writing persuasively. What I feared was my appearance and what they would think of me. I worried that if they didn't like me, they would make fun of me, mocking my weight, and I was not at all sure how to make them like me when I felt so very unlikable, and always had. I worried about stamina and whether or not I would be able to stand for 50 minutes. I worried about sweating in front of them and how they would judge me for it. I worried about what to wear because my standard uniform of jeans and t-shirts was too casual, and what little dressy clothing I did have would have been way too dressy for the classroom. The good thing about school is that students have been trained from an early age to follow the rules. They come to class and generally sit and behave in an orderly fashion. When you tell them to do things, they do those things. I walked into my first classroom, my heart pounding, sweating everywhere, my head ringing with all of my fears and insecurities. I was carrying a big box of Legos because I figured, if nothing else, the students might enjoy playing with Legos. At first, they didn't seem to realize I was their teacher, and I was not sure if they were unsure because of my size, my race, or what I vainly hoped was my youthful appearance. When I stood at the front of the classroom, they hushed, and I realized I was the teacher. I took attendance, my legs rubbery with anxiety, and then went into discussing the syllabus, the nature of the class, and what would be expected of them. Regular attendance, active participation, homework turned in on time, no plagiarism, and the like. It was reassuring to have these administrative details to go over with the students, but when I was done discussing the syllabus, I actually had to teach, and my anxiety rushed right back through me. At the end of that first class, as the students filed out of the room, I wanted to collapse with relief because I had survived those 50 minutes of being fat in front of 22, 18, and 19-year-olds. And then I realized I was going to have to do it all over again on Wednesday and Friday, week in and week out for the entire semester. I went to my classes. I taught. I studied. I tried to make friends and did, with a small measure of success. On weekends, I played poker at a casino in Barraga, the Ojibwe reservation about 40 miles away, hunched around the table with strange men, where I was intent on taking their money, which often I did. I still didn't sleep much. I kept eating, trying to find some kind of peace. And then, one day, I was walking home from the gas station across the street, where I had gone to buy cigarettes. I wore a knit cap on my head, a ratty t-shirt and pajama pants. I looked terrible, but no one at the sit-go cared. I didn't care either. A man started calling after me, shouting, "Hey, casino girl!" which only made me want to run. I assumed that he was going to make fun of me because I had long become accustomed to people, men mostly, calling out cruelties from their cars, their bicycles when they walked on by, letting me know exactly what they thought of my body. This was not that. He followed me to my apartment and up the stairs, so I quickly closed the screen door, latched it, and stared out at him. "You play poker at the casino," he said, and I nodded reluctantly. I tried to place him, but couldn't. He looked like every other white guy I saw around town. Dark, shaggy hair, a beard, wearing flannel and denim and work boots. "You're always talking shit at the poker table. Do you want to come hang out with me and my friends?" He pointed toward the distance. "Absolutely not," I told him, wanting him to go away, but he was mighty persistent. I was unsure what he wanted from me, but I knew it couldn't be anything good. Maybe he wanted me to go meet his friends so they could hurt me. Maybe he wanted money. I ran through the possibilities as he kept yammering on. Finally, he said he needed to get back to his friends, and I closed my door, unsettled. I couldn't sleep that night, staring at the ceiling, worrying about the strange man who followed me home. He kept coming back, night after night, and would always knock, then stand on my porch when I finally came to the door, talking to me through the screen, never trying to come inside. Eventually, it dawned on me that he was trying to ask me out. We went out to dinner at the nearby Ramada, which had a lousy restaurant but a good bar. His name was John. He was a logger. He loved to hunt and fish. He loved Lakers basketball. He had never lived anywhere but Michigan's Upper Peninsula. I was always skeptical of his attention, always waiting for him to reveal his true, cruel self. But day after day and week after week, he was good to me. He was solid. He ignored my casual barbs and resisted any and all attempts to push him away. He drank too much, but he was a happy drunk, the kind to laugh at his own jokes and fall asleep with a smile on his face. I quit smoking because I was getting older and realized I had been smoking for 18 years and that I had to at least try to love myself enough to give up one of my terrible but beloved habits. I was online all the time, starting to blog for websites like HTML Giant and The Rumpus. I discovered social networking. I started sending my writing out into the world again. John called anyone I knew online one of my little friends in the computer. Some weekends he would take me to his camp, the Upper Peninsula version of a remote lake cabin. There was no internet up there and barely any cell phone service. I had to disconnect from the safety of the virtual world and be present in the real world with him. He was the first man who touched me with any kind of gentleness, even when I asked him not to. He loved me, and over time, I realized I loved him too. We had a good relationship, one with more ups than downs. And then I came to the end of my doctoral program. I got a job teaching at Eastern Illinois University. I was starting to make a name for myself as a writer. I had every reason to feel hopeful. John and I had countless conversations about what we would do. He wanted me to stay. A part of me wanted to do it, to just settle down and become a logger's wife. But a bigger part of me wanted him to follow me because I had worked so hard for 5 years. I had accomplished something not many people, and even fewer black women, accomplish. I wanted to believe in our love story. I waited for him to make the grand gesture I wanted and needed from him. I wanted to believe I was worthy of that grand gesture. John and I had no dramatic arguments as we faced the end of my time in the UP. After I graduated, he helped me move to Illinois. We went to IKEA and shopped for furniture. He assembled bookshelves and a coffee table and checked the locks on the doors in my new apartment. We said goodbye in 100 different ways without actually saying goodbye. John's eyes were red when he headed back home. So were mine. We stayed in touch, and for a time there was a genuine yearning between us for the idea of what we could be. And still, that grand gesture never came. I fell back into the familiar embrace of self-loathing. I blamed myself. I blamed my body. Part 3. 30. I often refer to my 20s as the worst years of my life because that's exactly what they were. From 1 year to the next, though, things got better in that I became more functional as an adult. I was able to accumulate degrees and get better jobs. Slowly but surely, I tried to repair my relationship with my parents and redeem myself in their eyes. In the before, I had been a good girl, so I knew how to play that role. Some part of me was still willing to play that role after my last year in Arizona so that, despite my desperate loneliness, I might still be connected to something. Work, writing, family. But during my 20s, my personal life was an unending disaster. I did not meet many people who treated me with any kind of kindness or respect. I was a lightning rod for indifference, disdain, and outright aggression, and I tolerated all of this because I knew I didn't deserve any better, not after how I had been ruined and not after how I continued to ruin my body. My friendships, and I use that term loosely, were fleeting and fragile and often painful, with people who generally wanted something from me and were gone as soon as they got that something. I was so lonely, I was willing to tolerate these relationships. The faint resemblance of human connection was enough. It had to be enough, even though it wasn't. Food was the only place of solace. Alone, in my apartment, I could soothe myself with food. Food didn't judge me or demand anything from me. When I ate, I did not have to be anything but myself, and so I gained 100 pounds, and then another 100, and then another 100. In some ways, it feels like the weight just appeared on my body one day. I was a size 8, and then I was a size 16, and then I was a size 28, and then I was a size 42. In other ways, I was intimately aware of every single pound that accumulated and clung to my body. And everyone around me was also intimately aware. My family's concern became a constant chorus of nagging, always well-intended, but mostly a reminder of how I was a failure in the most basic of my human responsibilities, maintaining my body. They were relentless in asking me what I was going to do about my problem. They offered advice. They tried tough love. They offered to send me to specialists and spas. They offered financial incentives and new wardrobes and new cars. There is nothing they would not have done to help me solve the problem of my body. They mean well, my parents. They love me. They understand the world as it is and how there is no room for people of my size. They know that the older I get, the harder it will become to live at this size. They worry about my health and my happiness. They are good parents. My parents also want to understand. They are intellectual, smart, practical. They want my weight to be a problem they can address with the intellect they apply to other problems. They want to understand how I could have let this happen, let my body become so big, so out of control. We have that in common. And still, they are my personal obesity crisis intervention team. They have been actively pursuing the problem of my body since I was 14 years old. I love them, so I accept this, sometimes with grace and sometimes without. It is only now, in my early 40s, that I have started to put my foot down and say, when they try to broach the conversation of my body, no, I will not discuss my body with you. No, my body, how I move it, how I nourish it, is not your business. There was a time when every conversation included some kind of question about my weight. My parents, and my father in particular, make inquiries as to whether I am dieting, exercising, and/or losing weight as if all I am is my big fat body. But they love me. This is what I remind myself so I can forgive them. My father is the more passionate one in this crusade. Over the years, he has gifted me weight loss programs and books on weight loss, particularly those endorsed by Oprah. 1 year, it was Richard Simmons' Deal-A-Meal. He has sent me brochures for weight loss programs. He has told me to take time off from school because all those degrees you're getting aren't going to do you any good because no one is going to hire you at your size. He has told me, I am only telling you what no one else will, but of course he is telling me what the world is always telling me everywhere I go. When he hears of a new weight loss drug or program on the radio or on TV, at the airport, anywhere, he is quick to call me and ask me if I have heard of what he hopes is the silver bullet solution to the problem of my body. He has so much hope for what I could be if only I could overcome my body. His hope breaks my heart. My mother is subtler, and she frames her worry primarily around my health. She often discusses the health risks of obesity with me, diabetes, heart attack, stroke. She worries that my caretaking will fall to her if I do succumb to a terrible illness, and that she won't be up to the task. My brothers care, too, and I know they also worry, but they are my brothers, so they don't pressure me about weight loss. They are my defenders and also my tormentors. They have a song, the Humongous Song. My middle brother loves to serenade me with it. When I say humongous, humong la la, he will screech, and then everyone will laugh because it is oh so funny. It wasn't funny when I was a teenager, and it isn't funny now, but the song persists. I often become irate when they sing this song. My body is not a joke or fodder for amusement, but I suppose to many people it is. My family's constant pressure to lose weight made me stubborn, even though the only person I was really hurting was myself. The constant pressure made me refuse to lose weight to punish these people who claimed to love me but wouldn't accept me as I was. It became easier to drown out that chorus of concern, to tolerate the horrible ways people treated me, to ignore that I could no longer buy clothes in the mall or at Lane Bryant and sometimes not even at Catherine's. I became resentful that the only thing anyone ever wanted to focus on was my body, always unruly and disappointing. I shut down completely. I went through the motions. I learned how to tune out my parents, my brothers, people on the street. I learned how to live in my head, where I could ignore the world that refused to accept me, where I could block out the memories of the boys I could not forget, no matter how much time and distance yawned between me and them. For years at a time, there was me, and the woman I saw myself as while living in my head, and the woman who had to carry around my overweight body. They were not the same person. They couldn't be, or I wouldn't have survived any of it. 31. When you're overweight, your body becomes a matter of public record in many respects. Your body is constantly and prominently on display. People project assumed narratives onto your body and are not at all interested in the truth of your body, whatever that truth might be. Fat, much like skin color, is something you cannot hide no matter how dark the clothing you wear or how diligently you avoid horizontal stripes. You may become very adept at playing the role of wallflower. You may learn how to be the life of the party so that people are too busy laughing at or with you to focus on the elephant in the room. You may do whatever you have to do to survive a world that has little patience or compassion for a body like yours. Regardless of what you do, your body is the subject of public discourse with family, friends, and strangers alike. Your body is subject to commentary when you gain weight, lose weight, or maintain your unacceptable weight. People are quick to offer you statistics and information about the dangers of obesity, as if you are not only fat but also incredibly stupid, unaware, delusional about the realities of your body, and a world that is vigorously inhospitable to that body. This commentary is often couched as concern, as people only having your best interests at heart. They forget that you are a person. You are a body, nothing more, and your body should damn well become less. 32. An epidemic is the spread of a contagion. It is the unstoppable march of an infectious disease across humanity. Throughout history, there have been many epidemics. Measles, influenza, smallpox, the bubonic plague, yellow fever, malaria, cholera. But none is so deadly and pervasive, according to countless news reports, as the obesity epidemic. Instead of fever, leaking pustules, swollen glands, or lesions, your symptoms are girth and sheer mass. The obese body is the expression of excess, decadence, and weakness. The obese body is a site of a massive infection. It is a losing battleground in a war between willpower and food and metabolism in which you are the ultimate loser. Rarely does a day go by particularly in the United States, without some new article discussing the obesity epidemic, the crisis. These articles are often harsh, alarmist, and filled with false concern for people afflicted by this epidemic and a profoundly genuine concern for life as we know it. Oh, the burdens on the healthcare system, these articles lament. Obesity, these articles ultimately say, is killing us all and costing us an unacceptable fortune. There is, certainly, a very small grain of truth in these articles, in this frenzied panic. And also, there is fear, because no one wants to be infected by obesity, largely because people know how they see and treat and think about fat people and don't want such a fate to befall them. 33. As a fat woman, I often see my existence reduced to statistics, as if with cold, hard numbers, our culture might make sense of what hunger can become. According to government statistics, the obesity epidemic costs between $147 and $210 billion a year, though there is little clear information as to how researchers arrive at that overwhelming number. What exactly are the costs associated with obesity? The methodology is irrelevant. What matters is that fat is expensive and therefore a grave problem. Fat people are a drain on resources, what with needing health care and medication for their all-too-human bodies. Many people act like fat people are reaching directly into their wallets, the fat of other people a burden on their personal bottom line. Statistics also reveal that 34.9% of Americans are obese, and 68.6% of Americans are obese or overweight. The definitions of overweight and obese are often vague and obscured by arbitrary measures like BMI or various other indexes. And this just in, the obesity epidemic has recently crossed the Atlantic Ocean, and now many Europeans are falling prey to what is quickly becoming a pandemic, an epidemic of global proportions. What matters most is that too many people are fat. The epidemic must be stopped by any means necessary. 34. Few areas of popular culture focus on obesity more than reality television, and that focus is glaring, harsh, often cruel. The biggest loser is an unholy union of capitalism and the weight loss industrial complex. On the surface, the biggest loser is a television show about weight loss, but really, it's anti-obesity propaganda, offering wish fulfillment for people with unruly, overweight bodies, both on the show and in the viewing audience. The show allows the home viewer to feel motivated without actually doing anything. If the viewer does get motivated, they can participate at home and feel like they are, in some small way, part of the show. Meanwhile, they also have the satisfaction of watching fat people become less fat from one week to the next while competing for $250,000. I watched the first few seasons of The Biggest Loser avidly. The show offered the ultimate fat girl fantasy. You go to a ranch for a few months, and under the pressure of intense personal trainers, dangerously low caloric intake, the manipulations of reality show producers, and the constant surveillance of television cameras, you lose the weight you've never been able to lose on your own. During those first few seasons, I often toyed with the idea of auditioning to appear on the show, though, realistically, that could never happen. I'm too shy. I would go through withdrawal from the internet. I can't work out without music. If Jillian Michaels screamed at me, I would shut down or cry like a baby or strangle her. At the time, I was a vegetarian, and I was concerned because I don't eat Jennie-O turkey, a product the show shamelessly hawked for years by way of product placement. Appearing on the show simply was not and is not feasible for me. The longer The Biggest Loser has been on the air, however, the more the show has disturbed me. There is the constant shaming of fat people, and the medical professionals who take every opportunity to crow about how near death these obese contestants are. There are the trainers with their undeniably, implausibly perfect bodies, demanding perfection from people who have, for whatever reason, not had a previously healthy relationship with their bodies. There is the spectacle of the contestants pushing themselves in inhuman ways, crying and sweating and vomiting, visibly purging their bodies of weakness. This is not a show about people becoming empowered through fitness, though the show's slick marketing would have you believe that. The Biggest Loser is a show about fat as an enemy that must be destroyed, a contagion that must be eradicated. This is a show about unruly bodies that must be disciplined by any means necessary, so that through that discipline, the obese might become more acceptable members of society. They might find happiness, which can, according to the show, according to cultural norms, only be found through thinness. When we watch shows like The Biggest Loser and its many imitators, we are practically begging some power beyond ourselves, take these all-too-human bodies and make what you will of them. With the dramatic reveal of Rachel Fredrickson, the season 15 winner of The Biggest Loser, those of us who watch finally had an unimpeachable reason to be visibly outraged about the show and its practices, even though the show has been on the air and offering a damaging narrative about weight loss since 2004. When her season began, Fredrickson weighed 260 pounds. At her final weigh-in, on live television, she weighed 105, a 60% loss in mere months. During this revelation, even trainers Bob Harper and Jillian Michaels gaped at Fredrickson's gaunt body. She had disciplined her body the way she had been asked to, but apparently she had disciplined her body a bit too much. The Biggest Loser, we now know, should lose, but only so much. There are so many rules for the body, often unspoken and ever-shifting. In an interview, Harper would later say, "I was stunned." That would be the word. I mean, we've never had a contestant come in at 105 pounds. There was a wide range of responses in the press and on social media in the wake of seeing Rachel Fredrickson's new body. Her body, like most women's bodies, instantly became a public text, a site of discourse, only now because she had taken her weight loss too far. She had disciplined her body too much. As of late, several former contestants have leveled many accusations against the show, alleging that producers used forced dehydration, severely restricted caloric intake, and encouraged the use of weight loss drugs and more to help contestants reach their goals to make for better television. Even more damning was a medical study of one season's participants, led by metabolism expert Kevin Hall. The study found that 13 of the 14 contestants' metabolisms continued slowing even after their significant weight loss. This slowed metabolism contributed to the contestants gaining back most, if not all or more, of the weight they had lost on the show. The results are a stark reminder that weight loss is a challenge that the medical establishment has not yet overcome. It is certainly not a challenge a reality television show has overcome. It's no wonder that so many of us struggle with our bodies. In the 2 months after her big reveal, Fredrickson gained 20 pounds and reached, apparently, a more acceptable but still appropriately disciplined size. She explained that she lost so much weight because she was trying to win the $250,000 prize, but those of us who deny ourselves and try so hard to discipline our bodies know better. Rachel Fredrickson was doing exactly what we asked of her, and what too many of us would, if we could, ask of ourselves. 35. There are any number of weight loss shows in the vein of The Biggest Loser. On Extreme Makeover Weight Loss, the show takes a slightly more realistic approach to the project of significant weight loss, following fat people on their weight loss journey over a year. The trainer is far more genial than those on The Biggest Loser. We see more of the genuine struggle of weight loss, how it's not something that can be neatly accomplished and packaged for a televised audience. The message, though, is the same, that self-worth and happiness are inextricably linked to thinness. Some shows are hell-bent on exploitation. On Fit to Fat to Fit, physically impeccable trainers gain weight so they can better empathize with their clients. Then they have to lose the weight again so as to return to their natural, more perfect forms. The show chronicles their initial joy of eating with abandon, followed by the apparent misery of having to eat fast food and being fat, and finally, the lasting satisfaction of these trainers returning to their preferred state of impeccable fitness. Their clients are, by and large, accessories to the tragic, then triumphant gain-loss narrative the show loves. Khloe Kardashian, who has often been tormented by tabloids for weighing a bit more than 110 pounds, is hosting a show for E! Called Revenge Body, where participants get revenge on someone who has wronged them by losing weight and getting into shape. It's a hell of a thing, this idea that the way to truly settle old scores is to get thinner and fitter. The very premise of the show suggests that if you're fat, the people who have wronged you are probably gloating and reveling in your circumstance. On My 600-Pound Life, the show's morbidly obese subjects travel to Houston, where one Dr. Yunan Nazardin, or Dr. Now as he is often called, performs weight loss surgery on them. On this show, fat is treated as a pitiable spectacle. My 600-Pound Life revels in the stories of people who are so overwhelmed by their unruly bodies that they often have to be helped out of their homes by EMTs. They are at the point of no return, their bodies failing them, their loved ones exasperated and ready to walk away. The fat people on this show eat outrageous quantities of food and are often suffering from unresolved trauma. They also suffer from any number of physical ailments. They are, in many ways, cautionary tales. Watch her, out of breath, making her way to the mailbox. Watch him, sunken into the couch, eating from a greasy bag of hamburgers. Watch her struggle to get in and out of her car, the steering wheel choking her gut. We see these people, at their most vulnerable, in ill-fitting, often oversized clothes, if they can even wear clothes, their corpulence spreading everywhere, defying convention, defying our cultural norms. Each episode has a very familiar narrative arc in which we meet the subject and learn about their life, the seemingly miserable limitations of it. Then they meet Dr. Now, who chastises them and their loved ones for letting things get so out of hand. He tends to be palpably distressed by his patient and their family. Dr. Now often requires that these people go on a 1,200-calorie-a-day diet so they can lose 50 pounds before he will perform the weight loss surgery. He does the surgery, and it always goes well, and then the subject sees a therapist and stumbles along trying to live and eat differently. This show loves to gratuitously display the fat body, all the excess, the mounds of flesh. The surgeries are graphic, and we see insides, globules of fat being shoved aside by medical instruments as the obese body is medically brought to heal. Through medical intervention, the show offers redemption, or at least a chance at redemption. Each episode tries to end on a hopeful note, but sometimes, even with medical intervention, there is no happy ending, which for the show is a drastically thinner body. In that, My 600-Pound Life offers some truth. I hate these shows, but clearly, I watch them. I watch them even though sometimes they enrage me, and sometimes they break my heart, and all too often they reveal painfully familiar experiences of loneliness, depression, and genuine suffering born of living in a world that cannot accommodate overweight bodies. I watch these shows because even though I know how damaging and unrealistic they are, some part of me still yearns for the salvation they promise. 36. It's not just reality TV that is obsessed with weight. If you watch enough daytime television, particularly on women's networks, you are treated to an endless parade of commercials about weight loss products and diet foods, means of disciplining the body that will also fatten the coffers of one corporation or another. These commercials drive me crazy. They encourage self-loathing. They tell us, most of us, that we aren't good enough in our bodies as they are. They offer us the cruelest aspiration. In these commercials, women swoon at the possibility of satisfying their hunger with somewhat repulsive foods while also maintaining an appropriately slim figure. The joy women express over fat-free yogurt and 100-calorie snack packs is not to be believed. Every time I watch a yogurt commercial, I think, my God, I want to be that happy. I really do. It is a powerful lie to equate thinness with self-worth. Clearly, this lie is damn convincing because the weight loss industry thrives. Women continue to try to bend themselves to societal will. Women continue to hunger, and so do I. In one of her many commercials for Weight Watchers, Jessica Simpson smiles brightly and says, "I started losing weight right away. I started smiling right away." In her commercials for Weight Watchers, Jennifer Hudson shrieks about her newfound happiness and how, through weight loss, not, say, winning an Oscar, she achieved success. These are just two of many weight loss advertisements that equate happiness with thinness and, by the law of inverses, obesity with misery. Valerie Bertinelli was a Jenny Craig spokeswoman who proudly showed off her new body in 2012. Though she lost 40 pounds, she then gained some of that weight back. For that crime, her penance was to go on the talk show circuit trying to fight fat shaming. She would, of course, eventually head back to the gym when her press tour was over. She wanted, according to ABC News, to be back in bikini shape by summer. Kirstie Alley also rejoined the Jenny Craig fold around that time. "Without a coach helping us along the way, I don't think someone can make it for the long haul," Alley said. The public weight struggle spectacle is a popular fallback for once-famous women who yearn to recapture their former glory. Women, for that is whom these ecstatic diet food commercials and celebrity weight loss endorsements are for, can have it all when they eat the right foods and follow the right diets and pay the right price. What does it say about our culture that the desire for weight loss is considered a default feature of womanhood? 37. For most of my life, Oprah Winfrey has been a cultural icon who publicly struggles with her weight. For most of my life, I have also struggled with my weight, though mercifully, out of the public eye. Oprah has lost weight and celebrated that victory. She has gained weight and lamented that failure. In 1988, when her talk show was at the height of its popularity, she lost nearly 70 pounds on a liquid diet. She dragged a bright red radio flyer wagon filled with animal fat onto the stage of her show. She was resplendent, hair teased high, black turtleneck, tight jeans, as she performed her disgust at the spectacle of such fat, straining to try and lift the bag from the wagon. She was performing penance for the sin of having been fat. This is the woman who brought us the idea of living our best life, of becoming our most authentic selves. And yet, in 2015, Winfrey bought a 10% stake in Weight Watchers, an investment of $40 million. In one of her many commercials for the brand, she says, "Let's make this the year of our best body." The implication is, of course, that our current bodies are not our best bodies, not by a long shot. It is startling to realize that even Oprah, a woman in her early 60s, a billionaire and one of the most famous women in the world, isn't happy with herself, her body. That is how pervasive, damaging cultural messages about unruly bodies are, that even as we age, no matter what material success we achieve, we cannot be satisfied or happy unless we are also thin. There is the commercial where Oprah glows as she tells us she has eaten bread every day in 2016, and still the world continues to turn. Or the commercial where she shouts, "I love chips." There is the commercial where she is cooking and crowing about all the pasta she gets to eat. By the grace of Weight Watchers, she is able to control her body and enjoy carbohydrates. There is the inspirational commercial where she boasts of having lost 40 pounds, which I imagine means that she is finally living her best life. In yet another commercial, Oprah somberly says, "Inside every overweight woman is a woman she knows she can be." This is a popular notion. The idea that the fat among us are carrying a thin woman inside. Each time I see this particular commercial, I think, I ate that thin woman, and she was delicious but unsatisfying. And then I think about how fucked up it is to promote this idea that our truest selves are thin women hiding in our fat bodies like imposters, usurpers, illegitimates. In this same commercial, Oprah goes on to talk about how weight problems are never just weight problems, that there is often more to the story. This is often indeed true, but self-actualization, the catharsis of confronting demons, is not what Oprah is truly selling. Instead, she is telling us that our ultimate goal is this better, thinner woman we're supposed to diet toward. We will have our better body and her empire will continue to grow. 38. Gossip magazines keep us constantly abreast of what's happening to the bodies of famous women, the better to keep the rest of us in line. The weight fluctuations of famous women are tracked like stocks because their bodies are, in their line of work, their personal stock, the physical embodiment of market value. When a celebrity loses weight, she is often billed as flaunting her new body, which is in fact the only body she has ever had, but at a size more acceptable to the tabloids. When celebrity women have babies, their bodies are intensely monitored during and after, from baby bumps to post-baby bodies. After a celebrity has a baby, her size is assiduously tracked and documented until she once again resembles the extraordinarily thin woman we once knew. Celebrity bodies provide the unachievable standard toward which we must nonetheless strive. They are thinspiration, thin inspiration, a constant reminder of the distance between our bodies and what our bodies could be with the proper discipline. Celebrities understand the economy of thinness, and most of them are willing to participate in that economy, taking to social media where they pose for selfies with their cheeks sucked in to make themselves appear even gaunter. The less space they take up, the more they matter. 39. There is a taxonomy for the unruly, overweight human body, and that taxonomy becomes even more specific for the unruly, overweight woman's body. As a fat woman, I have become intimately familiar with this taxonomy because this is the vernacular with which far too many people discuss my body and its parts. In the culture at large, fat women can be many things in polite company. BBW, or a big beautiful woman, or a SSBBW, supersized big beautiful woman. She can be round, curvy, chubby, rotund, pleasantly plump, healthy, heavy, heavyset, stout, husky, or thick. In impolite company, a fat woman can be a pig, fat pig, cow, snow cow, fatty, blimp, blob, lardass, tub of lard, fatass, hog, beast, fatso, buffalo, whale, elephant, 2 tons of fun, and a slew of names I don't have the heart to share. When it comes to our clothing, we have plus-size clothing or extended sizes or queen sizes or women's wear. Specific body parts, problem areas, also get labels. Fupa, gunt, cankles, thunder thighs, high Susans, wings, cottage cheese thighs, hail damage, muffin tops, side boob, back fat, love handles, saddlebags, spare tires, double chins, gawks, man boobs, beer bellies. These terms, the clinical, the casual, the slang, the insulting, are all designed to remind fat people that our bodies are not normal. Our bodies are so problematic as to have specific designations. It's a hell of a thing to have our bodies so ruthlessly, publicly dissected, defined, and denigrated. 40. Part of disciplining the body is denial. We want, but we dare not have. We deny ourselves certain foods. We deny ourselves rest by working out. We deny ourselves peace of mind by remaining ever vigilant over our bodies. We withhold from ourselves until we achieve a goal, and then we withhold from ourselves to maintain that goal. My body is wildly undisciplined, and yet I deny myself nearly everything I desire. I deny myself the right to space when I am in public, trying to fold in on myself, to make my body invisible, even though it is, in fact, grandly visible. I deny myself the right to a shared armrest because how dare I impose? I deny myself entry into certain spaces I have deemed inappropriate for a body like mine. Most spaces inhabited by other people, public transportation, anywhere I could be seen or where I might be in the way, really. I deny myself bright colors in my daily clothing choices, sticking to a uniform of denim and dark shirts even though I have a far more diverse wardrobe. I deny myself certain trappings of femininity as if I do not have the right to such expressions when my body does not follow society's dictates for what a woman's body should look like. I deny myself gentler kinds of affection, to touch or be kindly touched, as if that is a pleasure a body like mine does not deserve. Punishment is, in fact, one of the few things I allow myself. I deny myself my attractions. I have them, oh, I do, but dare not express them, because how dare I want? How dare I confess my want? How dare I try to act on that want? I deny myself so much, and still, there is so much desire throbbing beneath my surfaces. Denial merely puts what we want just beyond reach, but we still know it's there. On a visit to Los Angeles, my best friend and I were drinking wine in a hotel room. During a pleasant lull in the conversation, she grabbed my hand to paint my thumbnail. She had been threatening to do this for hours, and I was resisting for reasons I could not articulate. Finally, I surrendered, and my hand was soft in hers as she carefully covered my nail in a lovely shade of pink. She blew on it, let it dry, added a second coat. The evening continued. I stared at my finger the next day as I sat on an airplane hurtling across the country. I could not remember the last time I had allowed myself the simple pleasure of a painted fingernail. I liked seeing my finger like that, particularly because my nail was long, nicely shaped, and I hadn't gnawed at it as I am wont to do. Then I became self-conscious and tucked my thumb against the palm of my hand, as if I should hide my thumb, as if I had no right to feel pretty, to feel good about myself, to acknowledge myself as a woman when I am clearly not following the rules for being a woman, to be small, to take up less space. Before I got on the plane, my best friend offered me a bag of potato chips to eat, but I denied myself that. I told her, "People like me don't get to eat food like that in public," and it was one of the truest things I've ever said. Only the depth of our relationship allowed me to make this revelation. And then I was ashamed for buying into these terrible narratives we fit ourselves into, and I was ashamed at how I am so terrible about disciplining my body, and I was ashamed by how I deny myself so much, and it is still not enough. 41. I hate myself. Or, society tells me I am supposed to hate myself, so I guess this, at least, is something I am doing right. Or, I should say, I hate my body. I hate my weakness at being unable to control my body. I hate how I feel in my body. I hate how people see my body. I hate how people stare at my body, treat my body, comment on my body. I hate equating my self-worth with the state of my body and how difficult it is to overcome this equation. I hate how hard it is to accept my human frailties. I hate that I am letting down so many women when I cannot embrace my body at any size. But I also like myself, my personality, my weirdness, my sense of humor, my wild and deep romantic streak, how I love, how I write, my kindness, and my mean streak. It is only now, in my 40s, that I am able to admit that I like myself, even though I am nagged by the suspicion that I shouldn't. For so long, I gave in to my self-loathing. I refused to allow myself the simple pleasure of accepting who I am and how I live and love and think and see the world. But then I got older, and I cared less about what other people think. I got older, and I realized I was exhausted by all my self-loathing, and that I was hating myself, in part, because I assumed that's what other people expected from me, as if my self-hatred was the price I needed to pay for living in an overweight body. It was much, much easier to just try and shut out all of that noise and to try and forgive myself for the mistakes I made in high school and college and throughout my 20s, to have some empathy for why I made those mistakes. I don't want to change who I am. I want to change how I look. On my better days, when I feel up to the fight, I want to change how this world responds to how I look, because intellectually, I know my body is not the real problem. On bad days, though, I forget how to separate my personality,